Hey, all you Spotify listeners. Check the description below to answer the poll to see what monster you would like to hear next on The Monsters of Fantasy. Welcome to The Monsters of Fantasy. This was written, produced, recorded, and edited by me, Sean McCarter. Monsters of Fantasy is a production in which I will explore the truly horrific side of the fantasy world known as Dungeons and Dragons. There are content warnings in the show notes below. Episode 18, The Yeti.
Hello there. After having been missing for more than a month, Nico came back. But only for a day at that. I had many questions for the old wizard, like how he has ancient historical texts that should very well be in a museum. But when he arrived, he did so with two other people. Two rather dapper-looking gentlemen, both humans, one with long black hair tied back behind his head, and the other practically bald. They both wore tight-fitting black tunics with a black and gold doublet. Stitched on both of their breasts was a golden octopus. I know I said that ominously, but I actually have no idea what it means. They could very well be calamari vendors or something. But they entered Nico's private study, and the door was shut that way for 2 days until we convinced Luna to go check on it. There was no trace of anyone save from a black book with the sigil of that octopus sitting on Nico's desk. We bantered back and forth about who should open it, and eventually Cadwin decided to take a look. As soon as his hands touched the book, it burst into a cloud that formed into the loose shape of Nico's face, accompanied by a disembodied head laughing at us. And now he's gone once again. But the gold keeps filling our pouches, and the job is rather fun despite the boss being an eccentric wizard. Somehow we all got put into our dream jobs here. Well, except Daisy. She always talks about how she was meant for the field study of these monsters, and is upset that she's been stuck on artifacts and research for the last few years. I don't understand why she would want to go out and fight these things, though. I get paid more now than I ever did pirating or adventuring. I mean, honestly, we can live simple lives of luxury in this castle, and all I have to do is read and catalog an old man's creepy obsession. Speaking of which, let's get started with this week's entry. Story taken from Sir Darian by Earl, a researcher previously employed here regarding his encounter with a Yeti.
Well, let me just start out. I'm not really from around here. It's funny. I got stationed out here about 8 years ago for the rotation. Every 6 months during the bulk of product movement between Voron and Shroudfrost, they'll switch out the two guards stationed here. You can opt to take a permanent position up here if you wish, but that's only been done by far and few people between. Sid and Gilbert, the eccentric wizards that reside here on behalf of the king, and there's an old hermit who lives half a day north of the village. The hermit's a deserter, technically. A king's spearman presumed dead after a voyage into the mountains. But no one here has ever said anything. That's why I decided to say myself. The closeness of the community. Unlike what I grew up with in Voron. A community, yeah, but here, we need each other. We survive and grieve together. Save the only oddballs in town, that golden structure that signified the King's Guard's Tower. But even then, its loneliness was due to their own desires. The townsfolk would bring pies and offer drinks, hell, even warmer clothes when the green-eared city boys underestimated what it was like in the north. The Metalborns down at the forge, Utum and his family at Silverjaw's Tankard, Maeve the local healer and her sons Emmett and Taylor. We are a community that is far better connected than any of the strange faces I saw passing by every day in Voron. It's been 8 long and great years since I left that city, and don't get me wrong, it's been stressful. Since then, the king did a few more swaps of the second guard, but not long after did he petition for me to become a full-fledged knight, which was just an honorific, honestly. It meant that I could assign my own men-at-arms here, as long as the king and I maintained contact. Honestly, the king hasn't cared about Shroudfrost or its expeditions around these parts in some time. Why do you think the wizards he sent to do arcane experiments spend more time on the theater and cheap magic shows than anything of actual use. And that distance only grew after the death of the White Fang. Thousands and thousands of miles to the western shore, previously untamed in fear of disturbing that ferocious dragon, had now been opened up thanks to some heroes. Rumor has it that it was the same lot that slew that weird sex demon that was running around here not too long ago, but my money is on one of the king's assassins. He's benefited vastly in the expansion into the north, building dwarven strongholds. He said it was to relocate populations and welcome even more men from our centuries-long kinship with the dwarves. I think he's using it to build something, but what? I have no idea. Either way, the westward expansion brought jobs and opportunities to the north in places that weren't Shroud Frost. But that was quite all right with me. Our tiny little village kept on. Before the Kingsguard were a permanent residence in the village, many would go out with the huntsmen and collect whatever meats they could. It helped pass the time, and let's be honest, it put our blades to use. There isn't much to do around here in terms of entertainment. Aside from the bar and the brothel, or Sid and Gilbert's magic shows. Let's just say, when they first asked if I wanted to join the hunts, I practically never stopped hunting. It distracted my thoughts from the cold, and it actively solved the issues of starvation. It was a great feeling carrying back an elk through the village to have many people cheering you on and thanking the gods for the feast we'd be having. It was apparent that my skill as a bowman while coming up in the King's Guard proved useful, because once I learned the local landscape and the beasts that hunt these dead woods, there wasn't a day that someone went hungry in Shroud Frost. Now, I won't take full credit for it, because those wizards, Sid and Gilbert, gods bless them, did help make a functioning greenhouse allowing vegetables. And if it wasn't for the Silver Jaws potatoes, we wouldn't have nowhere near as much alcohol or food to truly never go hungry. It just goes to show that when we came together as a community, we prospered. So, I find it weird to find someone not a part of our community and not a part of the Kingsguard asking about the unfortunate death of my squire, Peter Boris. Normally, I'd be holding a dagger to your throat and asking you the questions. But I gotta admit, kid, you're one smooth talker. I say squire only as an honorific for him in death. He was more like a son to me. At age 16, he started permanently accompanying me on the hunts. He was practically born to wield a bow. His father brought him to me as soon as he had heard that I decided to stay in Shroud Frost. Peter, being the youngest, didn't have any titles or land to inherit, and when he heard a knight was staying in the village, he seemed almost disappointed to see a middle-aged man in wool and leathers rather than a knight in gleaming armor. That disappointment soon faded when he found out I was an exceptional swordsman and an even better archer. He picked them both up pretty fast and became a vital part of the hunting parties. They were sent out in groups as large as 20 if a scout caught wind of a mammoth, or as small as 2 if we were just hunting the winter hare. We always went out as 2, though. I've seen what could happen in these woods, and it was better to at least have someone tell your story. I wasn't the only one. There was one other, John Shamanson, the son of the local seer. I don't believe too much in that divination stuff, but I gotta admit, after bringing the guy on a few hunts, I became a believer. If not then, I am now. The Shamansons had a knack for telling small futures and fortunes. They'll be the first to boast their abilities aren't that great, though. They know a few arcane conjurations passed down from their kin, but at the end of the day, their powers in divination and arcane aren't the strongest. Ask John and he'd tell you he could see events up to a day or two in advance, and even then it's just like pictures and fragments. Sometimes just a simple good or bad. He couldn't tell you if you'd be even alive a year from now, let alone what type of life you'd be living. But for hunting, he was great. He could tell the weather of the next day or see where something was hiding just from touching its tracks. He could tell if we were going to have a good day or a hunting struggle. He wasn't perfect. He was wrong a lot. Saying he foresaw a horrendous day, one to rue the existence of life, only for him to slip and chip a tooth on the ice. His response was that his dragon bones weren't always specific. Either way, John and Peter made for the perfect companions on a hunt. If we were trailing something large like a pack of elk or a giant boar, then we'd bring in more. But, for the most part, it was the three of us out there in that tundra. We'd only been riding for a day and a night when John, during our morning stew, rolled the dragon bones that would tell Peter's fate. I remember laughing at the fire with Peter that the great doom he foresaw was John's bow snapping, or at worst, a horse's leg breaking. It had been snowing pretty heavily the last few days, but it let up just the previous morning. That's why I want to set out on a hunt, or at least a scouting trip while the weather was clear. When John told us of his reading, though, we took proper precautions and had him double-check the weather, something he could do a bit more accurately with some time. After he assured us that we had clear skies and that these snake eyes, as he called them, didn't foretell a coming blizzard, we kept on tracking through the dead woods. About halfway through the day, Peter came upon some tracks of a hare. After a debate on whether we should settle on rabbit stew, something I was perfectly fine with, or a mammoth to feed thousands, something the other two desperately wanted. They had only encountered one themselves in person and were told to keep perimeter watch the entire time because they were too young. These two were wanting to bloody their spears with the thrill of the hunt. The thrill was pumping through their veins just as much as mine, and it helped warm us as we kept pressing on through the cold. Just before the suns were hidden by the God's Peak mountain range did Peter come across some odd tracks. They looked like human prints, but the size was from no man I'd ever seen. Peter could almost fit curled up with inside it. I heard John exclaim that there was no way we were following giant prints. I calmed him down to assure they weren't giant prints. First, giant prints would be much larger. And second, the giants stayed up at the very top of God's Peak, amongst the clouds. I assured him that there was no way that these were giant prints. But that didn't really help, though, because that narrowed it down to a Yeti. And when I said that, the two boys squealed under their breaths. Now, neither of them had a personal vendetta against the things. It's just there have been stories from ages past told of how settlers of Shroud Frost had to fight and fend off Yeti tribes for many years to come. But that was centuries ago. They had all been driven into the mountains, and we were a week's travel from there, and that was on horseback. Something didn't sit right with me about the situation, but before I could express these concerns, John had already used his gifts to tell which way the thing ran off to. And not shortly after was Peter snapping the reins of his mare, excited to go and take down a Yeti. I'll go ahead and let you know that Yeti tracking isn't all that hard. They are large, clumsy creatures that smell horrendous. And that was what first alerted us that we were getting close to her. Her stench was so overwhelming and wretched that our horses refused to get within a mile of the thing. I remember dismounting and beginning to tell the two boys that they should stay there while I scouted ahead when John fell from his horse. Nothing terrible, just a bump of his head and a bruised bum. It cut me off, and as I was laughing, I couldn't help but think that all my worries were because of John's stupid bones. I told the boys to circle the creature and flank it. We were in the woods and the trees were tall and strong but thinly spread. I told them to take a wide berth. Once we had it surrounded on all three sides, we would close in on it. At this point, it had already gotten dark, but luckily we had the light of the full moon and a clear sky to guide us. I let the other two break off, and all three of us advanced stealthily through the snow. I was the first to see her camp. There was no fire, but there had been a feast. She sat hunched over the carcass of an elk, the large bones of which were practically picked clean. It was clear she had been sleeping there since before the snow let up. For the clearing we were in had to be made by her. All the trees in roughly a 40-foot area around here had been uprooted and made into a crude but undeniable shelter. The moon's light didn't allow me to see inside the structure, but I saw what looked like a pile of clothes inside. I thought it was clothing because she had some garments wrapped around herself. It seemed to be made of bear skin, or worse, Yeti, for the fur was almost as white as her. Its back was facing me, but even hunched over, practically on her knees, she was taller than I. I couldn't make out if we had caught her in the middle of eating, so I started to survey the rest of the camp. And that's when I saw Peter. He had come up on the right side of me and the beast and was hanging behind the edge of a large evergreen tree. He sat there leaning against the tree edge with his bowstring pulled taut, seemingly looking at me for approval, a signal for him to lay low. Now, seeing this thing in person, it was clear we needed to make it back to the village. She was bigger than the stories made them ever seem, and an old man with a sword and two bowmen, or rather bow children, weren't going to be enough to do this safely, let alone at all. If we were to have a chance at this, we would need the metal-born children in their armor. Everyone's head snapped to the sound. I couldn't see it, but somewhere just beyond the tree line, John had snapped a twig under his foot. It wasn't even that loud. But to everyone there, the snapping echoed off the trees around us in the dead silence. The Yeti started standing up to its full height. It didn't quite reach the top of the treetops with its horns, but its black ram-like protrusions wrapped around themselves twice before jutting out in front of its face. It sniffed at the air with its ape-like snout towards where John was surely hiding. It then quickly glanced at the hut, and then down at the carcass. It faced back towards John and let out a deep, bellowing shout. I felt my heart racing as I watched the beast open its maw and scream into the night air. Its sharp canines gleamed from the saliva. It ripped the cloth from its chest, throwing the bundle to the ground, and started sprinting towards the tree line. My eyes were drawn to the pile of rags as it hit the ground because I saw a bundle of white fur roll out into the snow. Before I could say or do anything, though, it seemed that Peter had the guts to act first. I don't know if it's guts or stupidity, though. "Hey!" His voice cracked out across the clearing. She stopped dead in her tracks, spinning around and kicking up snow as she did so. I saw that Peter still had his bow drawn and was trembling as he kept it trained on her. She wasn't looking at him, though. She was staring at the moving bundle of rags that was between the two. I shouted into the night air for him to run. I screamed and begged as the creature bounded and leaped to the other side of the clearing. The entire time it was screaming at the top of its lungs, drowning out everything but its willowing cries. I looked at John, but he just sat there with his bow drawn taut. I saw ice crystals forming around his hands. His eyes, previously brown, were an icy blue. I screamed once again for him to run, but I already saw the covering of ice racing up his legs, freezing him into place. John, hearing all the shouting, ran out into the clearing as well, just in time to see the monster rip apart our poor Peter. I stayed long enough to see the beast rip Peter's arm clean off before I had to turn tail and run. Once John saw me take my leave, we were both sprinting and whistling for our horses. I don't know if she followed us or not. I never turned back to look. John and I ran our horses almost to death, only stopping twice the entire journey back, and both times we did so only to let the horses rest. I tried talking to John about what happened and what we would tell the villagers, but he just stayed quiet the entire time. I tried making sure he knew it wasn't his fault. You know, how teens can be. I figured once we got back and he had a chance to talk his folks, he'd be a bit better. But when we made it back to the village, I dropped him off and I went riding once again, going another 2 days without sleep to go and track down that Yeti. But we could never pick back up the trail. We found the clearing again, though, bathed in the blood of poor Peter. We never found a body to bring back and bury for Lady Boris either. A couple of other men went out towards the mountains seeking vengeance, but I decided to finally return home and get some rest. But to break my heart one final time, when I returned, Mrs. Shamison had told me her son John had set out in the dead of night. He'd taken all of his supplies and hunting equipment with him on this trip. I asked if she knew what he was up to, but both of us knew he was planning on some fool's mission of vengeance. What remaining men and women that weren't out hunting the Yeti then went looking for John. But as you can guess, we never found him. His mom still stays up the road if you want to ask her about it. She said her son's still alive, living out west, she says. But she can't give us more than that. Part of me hopes the kid is doing all right out there on his own. End of story.
Daisy says that Earl never returned after taking this statement. He sent the physical copy back with a carrier pigeon, along with a note saying he was going to get a statement from this John Shameson. I asked her why she wants to get back out in the field if so many researchers have gone missing. She just said that she signed up to fight and slay monsters in the beginning, not this. She said she's not inherently banned from doing outside research, just that unless she spends a certain amount of hours a week in artifact storage with Luna, then the gold she was promised doesn't show up in her room. Something I figured out, actually. Took a week off, dare I say, to go catch up with the Arithras, and I came back to a severely cut pay. And Arithras is doing well, researching the mountains that surround Argonvolt's lair. She's got herself a place to stay in the dwarven city of Kragsvolt, and after she coordinated a teleportation circle for me in their library, I decided to stay a few days and help her out. I couldn't tell Nico I was taking a vacation, though, because he never seems to be around. Somehow, though, he knew I didn't do a statement that week. I don't know what Daisy's complaining about, though. The weather's getting far too cold out this time of year, and I'm perfectly fine staying inside safe and warm, reading my stories and cataloging monsters. The Yeti. The Yeti is a large monstrosity that resides in the tundras of our world. They are primarily found in the caves alongside mountain ranges. It is rumored that some of the first men saw structures and civilizations made by Yetis, but their numbers have dwindled drastically since then. Physiology. The Yeti can stand anywhere from 7 feet to 12 feet for their larger males. They are covered completely all over, save their face and palms, by a thick coating of white winter fur. This allows them to easily blend into their surroundings and stay warm in it. They look sort of like a giant ape with horns. They aren't quite beast-like, though, in nature, something we'll cover in their abilities section. It is said they were created by the Raven Queen herself because she was sad that no humans were fit to roam her icy tundras. Not just looks, though. They are smart enough to have civilizations and develop their own languages and colloquialisms. There's actually a lot here done by Nico and some previous researchers into the customs of these creatures. He even alludes to an even more powerful Yeti, kind of like a Yeti king, something the first settlers called an abominable Yeti. But let's not get carried away with legends just yet. The Yeti is a primarily nocturnal creature, meaning that it can see and sense stuff in the dark. That doesn't stop it from using its nose, though. Almost like a bloodhound, the Yeti can discern the direction and differences and the stenches around it. That is surprising, given how smelly some of them can be. Weaknesses and resistances. Well, it should go without saying that this monster is immune to frost-based attacks entirely. And while it isn't weak to fire in the sense that fire will hurt it any more than fire hurts, say, a human, but they do have a strange aversion to it. It seems that whatever frost deity gave these monstrosities their power has bestowed an internal irrational fear to fire. Attacks and abilities. Admittedly, it only really has one ability. We've gone and called it Chilling Gaze, as featured here in the story. The Yeti can look at a creature, and as long as the two can make eye contact, then it can bestow a curse of ice on the victim, essentially freezing them into the spot and paralyzing them. Like most curses, if used repeatedly, you can gain resistance to it. However, it seems this resistance may only last at an hour at most. If you are caught in the Yeti's chilling gaze, then it will use its claws and ape-like strength to rip you apart. As shown here by the young Peter, finding himself between a Yeti and her cubs.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with your friends and family and leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at monstersof_ for all news and teasers for upcoming episodes. Today's story was the backstory to a divination wizard PC that I decided to expand on and narrate for my player. Join me next week as Kezvar finds a tale from another realm, one beyond his reach, about a special treant. Thank you for listening. Until next time.